Hello, good morning. We're going to go ahead and get the conference call and webinar going very shortly. I'd like for everybody who is on the call to introduce themselves first, and then we'll have Tina introduce herself. And what I would ask you to do is please hold all your questions to the end of the when we get done with the slides. If you have any questions during the call, you may stick them in the little chat box, which is on the far left bottom of the screen, if everybody's screen is the same. But please, and then if you are on a speakerphone of any sort, please mute your phone. You can use star 6 to mute, or star 7, or you can use, if you have a mute button on your phone, that's fine too. You don't have to mute your phone if you're, you know, if you're not in a place where we're going to hear all the noise, okay? So let's get started. Please introduce yourselves and what agency you're with, and if you're working, if you're a grantee and you're working with a housing authority, please just mention which housing authority it is. So let's get started. Please introduce yourselves.
This is Ivy Williams with Grand Junction Housing Authority, and I've got Danette, Jamie, Brenda, and Maria with me.
Hi, this is Karen with Delta County Health, and I have Joe from the Delta Housing Authority.
Hello, this is John from Denver Public Health, and I have John with Denver Public Health, working with Denver Housing Authority.
John, did you sign into the webinar? Oh, you're at a remote. You're not at a computer, right?
Yeah, I'm outside.
Okay.
So I'm calling from my cell phone and looking at these wonderful PowerPoints you sent me.
Okay, wonderful.
This is Jill with the State of Colorado Health Department.
This is Wendy with the American Lung Association.
All right. This is Pete Bialik, and I will be the moderator. I'd like to welcome Tina Pettengill. I met Tina years ago. We had a conference at Jim Bergman's home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think the, I don't know if Tina would agree with me, I think that that was probably one of the, at least for me, it was one of the best conferences I've ever attended on smoke-free housing. Is some of the, one person from every state that was currently working on smoke-free housing, and it was quite a good conference. Tina was one of the many presenters. So without further ado, Tina, one of the, I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce yourself and tell people a little bit more about who you
okay.
are and what you do.
And I am using my phone on speaker, so if you guys receive any feedback or doesn't sound quite right, just let me know, and I'll go ahead and hold the phone. So as Pete said, my name's Tina Pettengill. I have a master's in public health degree from Indiana University, but I've been in Maine for over 10 years, and most of that time, let's see, I guess about almost 9 years, I've been working on smoke-free housing, as well as I do some consulting in smoke-free policy. But we, in Maine, we started working on this. We were one of really the first few states that were starting to look at this and talk about this. I mean, just not because we were ahead of the game, but because we were getting a lot of complaints from tenants about the smoke intrusion into their units. We were also getting phone calls from landlords wanting to know what to do about it. So, you know, very similar to every other state in the country, but when we looked around, we realized we didn't have any resources and decided to create some resources. So I'm the founder and still remain a chairperson and a consultant for the Smoke-Free Housing Coalition of Maine. We have a varied partners from across the state that make up this coalition. And we work not just with public housing authorities, of course, but we work in, with market rate subsidized housing. You know, pretty much anyone who owns a property or manages a property, we will and have worked with them. So we worked with hundreds of landlords across the state of Maine, as well as probably now hundreds of landlords across New England. And it's, you know, it's been an interesting ride, and the landlord populations and the tenant populations, obviously, there's a pretty big disparity in the messages that we want to relay to them and make sure that they understand. So today Pete asked me to talk about communicating with tenants, especially tenants that, you know, aren't real thrilled about a smoke-free policy being implemented in their building or on their property. I do have quite a bit of experience with that. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. Our most recent was this summer. Well, let me back up one more step. The Maine has 20 public housing authorities and 5 tribal housing authorities. 19 out of our 20 housing authorities are smoke-free. And one of our tribal housing authorities is smoke-free. We've worked very hard to make that happen. And this summer, our 19th housing authority that went smoke-free was the Portland Housing Authority, which is our largest housing authority in Maine, and they service about 3,000 individuals. So one of our, you know, as with any property owner, we talk about how are you going to communicate this with tenants and how are you going to make it successful. And Portland Housing Authority decided that they would like to have tenant meetings. And they decided, actually, they would like to have tenant meetings at every major building. So, or every major site, I should call it, because some of the, you know, family complexes, that we certainly didn't go into every building. But we did 8 tenant presentations this summer, and they're still very fresh in my mind. So a lot of what I'm going to share with you is based on, you know, my most recent experiences, and they're probably more relatable to some of your experiences because it was a larger housing authority as well. So, let's see if I can figure this out. There it goes. So we have kind of come up with key premises to prevent future problems. And I would say most of these premises are around communication, proper communication, positive communication. And the first thing, obviously you're not going to skip right to the tenants. You have to work with the property owner or the housing authority. And you really want to make sure that housing authority is proud of this accomplishment. This is the right thing to do. This is something that's going to protect all of your tenants, not just some of them, but all of them. And, you know, I'm sure you guys know the statistics, but, you know, usually about 70% of tenants, whether they are low income, whether they smoke, whatever their circumstances are, about 70% of tenants want to live in smoke-free housing. So when you look at that and you also look at the rate of smoking, which even with low-income tenants hovers around 30% to 35%, you know, you're talking about a vast majority of people who don't smoke and a vast majority of people who want to live in smoke-free housing. So that's why I say, I don't mean to be like kind of, you know, indignant or flip, but this is the right thing to do. This is what a huge majority of your people want, and this is the only way to protect all of your tenants from the toxins and secondhand smoke. My point is that you really need that housing authority to buy into that. They have to really feel that and display that in all of their communications, in the way they speak about the policy, that this truly, they're doing truly a really good thing. And the minute they start to portray that in such a positive way, everything changes. Because they need to be the champion, and they need to know that they're doing this for the right reasons. So I think I can't emphasize that enough. once they decide that this is the right thing to do and this is the way they're going to go, and the board buys into it, and we also, just as a side note, really recommend that an expert in smoke-free housing present to the board and make sure the board really truly understands the impact of secondhand smoke on tenants, as well as, you know, what a smoke-free policy actually means. So anyhow, as soon as that the board votes it through, you're ready to go. The property owner now needs to have the policy set. They need to follow that policy. No exceptions. I always relate this, and maybe this isn't fair really, but I relate this to my children who are three pretty little kids, and you know, it's to give them an inch, they take a mile type of thing. And that's a generalization, of course, for tenants. But the minute that they let one tenant slide and they say, oh, it's fine, you know, I'm going to give him four warnings instead of the customary one warning. Just bad idea. You have a policy, you have to follow that policy. And that goes back to the first bullet. You've set this policy for a reason. Now you need to follow it for that same reason. No different than any other policy that you might have, like taking the garbage out or having pets or whatever the policy is. It's just really important to make sure folks know that this is the policy and you're serious about that policy. A piece of that, of course, is to train all your staff to ensure that policy is followed, including no matter what, but I suppose I could put the caveat, including, if necessary, disciplinary measures for staff who do not follow the policy. We've had issues with that in one of our housing authorities, that their biggest problem is their staff. They have smoking. Their particular policy is 25 feet from all doors, windows, and entrances, kind of a standard policy. And they have staff who are, you know, smoking 2 feet outside of the entrances. They're also smoking in their vehicles, which is actually illegal in Maine, to smoke in a company vehicle. But the point is, if you, again, back to kind of bullet point number one, if your staff and your administration is not following the policy themselves or not being respectful of that policy, you can't expect tenants to follow the policy. So I guess what I'm saying here is start with yourselves. You know, look at yourselves. And are you being a model parent? Like I said with my children, are you being the model parent? Are you portraying the policy in an important and respectful way? If so, your chances of success are going to be much, much higher with your tenants. So other key communication points, moving on more to tenants themselves, are constant and consistent messaging. Kind of look at all the different ways that tenants receive messages. Maybe you want to have tenant meetings, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about tenant meetings today. Maybe you have newsletter articles that are a monthly newsletter that goes out to your tenants. Maybe you have an electronic communication with your tenants. You certainly, no matter what, you want to have a letter to your tenants, not only informing them of the policy as much in advance as possible, but also, you know, within a few weeks of the policy going into effect, you need to have a reminder letter. That certainly is not a standalone. You want to incorporate all these pieces in your messaging campaign, but that is certainly a basic. We really recommend that letters to the editor go in, LTEs, press releases. We're working with Housing Authority right now, Sanford Housing Authority, who was one of the first housing authorities in Maine to go smoke-free in 2005, but they included an unlimited grandfathering policy. And at that time, that was pretty good policy. Now we know, you know, that's not good policy anymore. We know too much to have an unlimited grandfathering policy. So we are now kind of looping back with a couple of housing authorities like Sanford who had unlimited, and they're abolishing that grandfathering policy on June 1st. So the first thing we talked about is how do we message to tenants appropriately? How do we prepare them? And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But then how also do we communicate to the public? And we have letters to the editor ready, drafted, and ready to go. For example, we're going to have a community member write in a thank you to the Sanford Housing Authority for passing this policy and protecting the health of all tenants. We're going to have a board of commissioners write an LTE, and we'll have at least one tenant write a LTE as well. It's just good practice. They don't take much time. If people are standing behind the policy, they're willing to do it. So, and then if you have to play defense and, you know, if there's an outcry and people are upset, you have some things that are ready to go to kind of combat that. Same press releases, you know, along the same lines. You want to communicate to tenants why you're doing this. You want to communicate with the community why you're doing this. And make sure that they understand the housing authority's point of view. And the only way you can do that and control that is, hopefully control that is through press releases. So we recommend at least two press releases, one as soon as the policy passes, and one before it goes into effect, and maybe one a couple weeks after if you are providing cessation or other types of services to tenants, you know, that's a great thing to let people know how you're supporting your tenants. And then, of course, signage. It seems like kind of a no-brainer, but signage is really important. And I think sometimes people overlook the importance of signage. And what I'm talking about is simple signs on near every entrance, if possible, maybe on the entrance to different housing authority properties. Certainly you want a sign in front of the administrative offices. You know, in Maine we are able to provide some signage with some grant dollars, not as much as folks would like, but we've also developed templates so it's easy for people to create signs. But signage is really important because we know in smoke-free environment work in general that when people see signage telling them to not do something like smoke, you know, somewhere around 80% of people comply just because there's a sign. So it's just another form of communicating the policy as well as increasing the compliance. And then again, your leadership and positive communication from property manager, your own, your resident service coordinators, whoever is out on the street per se, communicating with the tenants on a daily basis. Again, they need to be trained. They need to have some key talking points and messages and, because they're the ones on the floor. They're the ones really out, that are going to make this successful for you. So it's really important not to overlook the training of all of those types of staff. Oh, and I should have included maintenance staff on there. They're really pretty key people as well. In terms of key messages to tenants, and again, these are a little different than your messages to landlords, but we pretty much emphasize three things. The health benefits for all people. And of course, there's a myriad of things that go into that. But basically, a smoke-free building is the only way to protect everyone in the building. Fire safety. I'm sure you guys have as many fires there as we do here as a result of smoking in units, especially smoking and having oxygen tanks. And of course, the deaths from smoking household deaths from cigarette fires are the number one cause of fire deaths. So, you know, that's a pretty that's something people understand and is really tangible to them. They likely also know somebody, or you can pull up an article from another housing authority that someone has died recently or people were displaced because of fires related to smoking. Unfortunately, they're not too hard to find. And then the last one, but certainly not the least important, is no one has to quit smoking and no one has to leave. No one has to be evicted because of this policy. A smoke-free policy is not about people quitting smoking. It's about people taking the smoke outside where it will not harm other people. So that's probably, that's a really big message. And in a minute, I'm actually going to run through fairly quickly our kind of canned tenant presentation, and you'll see how many times that we hit on those three messages. It's a lot. Okay, so moving on to tenant meetings specifically, because I think that is a key way to reach people. It's also, I think, a very valid way to show people that, to show your tenants that you want to hear from them. It doesn't mean you're going to change your mind about the policy, but that you want to hear from them and you want to hear their concerns and how you may be able to help them with their concerns or incorporate their concerns into your policy or your implementation plan. I like the idea of tenant meetings. Not everybody does them, but I think you're going to have more success if you do. You should, of course, understand that at tenant meetings, for the most part, and I've done a lot of them, you know, you're going to get people who smoke and people who are pretty irritated that you're even thinking about this policy. And depending on when you hold the tenant meetings, and that's really something for you to consider when you look at your population. Do you want to hold the tenant meetings before you pass the policy, after you pass the policy? I think it works. It kind of works either way. We've done it both ways. I don't think there's a right answer as to when to hold tenant meetings. In Portland this summer, when we held them before the policy passed. And people kind of saw right through that. They were pretty pissed off that they, probably what they said would not change the policy implementation. But on the other hand, they did appreciate a chance to vent their concerns. So either way, you're going to get people who are upset. Some people who may be more upset than you would like to be at a meeting, but there's ways to control that. And, of course, you want to encourage everyone to come, especially folks who, non-smokers or even smokers, who want the policy to be passed. You want to really encourage everyone to come and voice either their support or their opposition or their ideas around the policy implementation. So here's how we have done our tenant meetings, and I think through a little bit of trial and error, we've come up with some pretty successful template, if you will. The first thing is, again, encouraging everyone to come, making it very widely known when, where the tenant meeting is going to be, make it convenient for them, and have it in your community rooms at, you know, convenient times. Property owner, or at the very least your residential service coordinator, should be there. You should have at least two staff in the room, as well as, I really think it's important to, again, have a secondhand smoke and or smoke-free housing expert in the room to do the majority of the presentation. What I always say is, let me be the bad guy. You know, if that's necessary for someone, if it's necessary for someone to be the bad guy, let it be me, because I don't have to work with these people in the future. But I can be the one that presents all the science and presents all the reasoning, and if they need to blame somebody, it's okay to blame me. So I think that's worked pretty well in the instances that we've done tenant meetings. And if it's not you, if like someone who's on the phone, I heard someone said they're from the Lung Association, you know, maybe Pete would be willing to go out and give presentations. I don't know. But, again, I think it's really nice to have somebody from an outside group. So the important thing, though, is the property owner or, like I said, the residential service coordinator, someone, at least two staff people are there, and they set the tone. They open the meeting. They set the tone and the basic ground rules of the meeting. It sounds a little elementary, but you don't always know who's in the room, and you certainly don't know how upset people might be. So it's better to be safe than sorry. And I'm talking really elementary, saying, you know, welcome, we appreciate you coming. Our objective of the meeting is to X, Y, and Z, to, you know, whatever that may be, to collect their thoughts or hear their concerns, whatever it may be. And here are the ground rules. We're going to talk one at a time. We are not going to interrupt each other. We are going to be respectful of each other and of your presenters. And if those rules aren't followed, you will be asked to leave immediately. Again, it sounds a little kind of rudimentary, but I think it's really important to set that tone of respect. And that's something that we actually talk about within our presentation as well, is respecting people who don't smoke and don't want to be involuntarily exposed to secondhand smoke, but also for the non-smokers to be respectful of people who smoke and how hard this is for them, because it's a difficult transition to go from smoking in your unit to smoking outside, especially in a state like Maine, but also Colorado. You know, it's not always, well, everyone tells me it's sunny all the time in Colorado, but sometimes it's snowing and sometimes it's raining and a lot of times it's cold, and that's a big transition for folks. So you just don't want to minimize that. And then knowing what you want to accomplish during those tenant meetings as a staff, is it just to hear people's concerns? Is it to brainstorm what other things you might be able to include in your implementation plan to support your tenants? You know, figure out what your objectives are before the meetings so you can make sure that you meet those objectives. Again, I start the presentation with the smoke-free housing expert. The reason for that, I've talked about a couple things, but the other piece of that is you need everyone to know how dangerous secondhand smoke is. You need everyone to start on the same page. When you spend the first 15 minutes talking about the dangers of secondhand smoke and the science behind secondhand smoke, it becomes much harder for someone to make an argument about why they should continue to smoke in their building. When you talk about how secondhand smoke causes sudden infant death syndrome, again, it becomes much more difficult for someone to argue that, well, I don't care, I should still be allowed to smoke in my unit. So once you get folks all on the same page with this is a dangerous toxin. I mean, we have looked at studies that say it's more dangerous than asbestos and lead and all kinds of other toxins. So we're not talking about something that, you know, just on a whim the housing authority decided to start to regulate. This has been studied for, 100 years. So, I think it's really important to get everyone on the same page. And then end with your timeline. Your property owner or the RSC can thank the presenter and then come up and talk about next steps. Again, making sure people know what to expect. If it is fully your intent that you're going to bring it to the Board of Commissioners to vote on it next week, tell people that. Don't try to hide that from people. They're going to find out anyway. That stuff's public information for the most part. And you're not going to earn anybody's trust by not being straightforward with them. So, and if your timeline is, I don't know what's going to happen with this, but sometime in the next 6 months, the board's really going to be taking a hard look at it, then tell them that too. One thing we found is, you know, especially in some of the buildings that have elderly and disabled, you know, you've got folks with all kinds of different issues and problems, anxiety disorders. You know, one of our meetings this summer, somebody with a severe anxiety disorder came, and the thought of having to go outside to smoke, and not because the policy was set, I mean, we hadn't set a date or anything, but just the thought of having to change that behavior was sending him into a tailspin. So it was important to know that, because now the resident service coordinator can sit down with that person and give more details. They can check in with him a little bit more frequently. You know, those are the types of support that hopefully you should be able to give your tenants. So this is the beginning of our tenant presentation that we, like I said, kind of our canned presentation that we do in Maine. Are there maybe, Pete, do you think we should pause for questions, or should I go ahead and run through these?
I think you should go ahead. I do have, can you, and maybe you can do this as you go through, maybe talk a little bit about some of the generic complaints that you get. I think we know what those are. The only other thing that, and if you want, we can talk about this later as well. One of the things that recently we did some focus group work with disparate populations on smoking cessation.
Uh-huh.
And one of the interesting things that was found in that process was that often these people, in terms of getting the message to them, that they will respect their own peers more than they might respect, you know, somebody from, you know, a health department. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right that the health message, you know, ideally should come from a health expert.
Right, exactly. In terms of generic complaints, do you mean prior to a policy being implemented or after a policy has been implemented?
Both, you know, as you're going through the process, what are some of the complaints that you, I mean, you know, I think you already raised one of them, you know, having to go outside, you know, I'm disabled, or these people are disabled, we really can't send them out in the cold, and, you know, those are the kind of things that, you know.
Sure. I mean, I think we've heard, we've heard every complaint you could think of. I mean, people don't like to change much of the time. Again, I don't mean to make generalizations over any population, but I'm just saying, if you know, we get, well, I've lived here 20 years. I don't care what policy you pass, I'm going to smoke in my unit. I mean, that was not a smart thing for that tenant to say, frankly, in front of the property owner. But people are really indignant sometimes around this type of policy change. And if nothing else, it's because they have to change the way they go about their daily life. And that is difficult. Again, I don't want to minimize how difficult it is. You're asking someone, maybe some people who might smoke 2 packs a day, to go outside. And for somebody, that could mean going outside 40 times a day. I mean, that's probably, that person will end up cutting down. But the, oh boy, we've gotten complaints of, I think also a common complaint is, after the policy has passed, is, you know, well, so-and-so, you know, Joe in the next unit is still smoking. And that's a tough one because the Housing Authority certainly should and needs to check up on that frequently as well. But I know there are many instances when, you know, Sally, who's making the complaint, just doesn't like Joe and has never liked Joe, and is just trying to find a reason to complain about Joe. So that's a tough situation to be in. Those are the types of situations. Again, we encourage the Housing Authority staff to be right on it when that policy goes into effect. you have to nip that kind of thing in the bud. And you have to have a process for nipping it in the bud. Are you going to, if Sally makes a phone call, can you get on the walkie-talkie and immediately get a maintenance person over to Joe's place? Because obviously you're going to be able to smell smoke. If Joe's been smoking, you're going to be able to smell it. There's no two ways about that. So how are you going to handle those complaints, I think, are really important. I think the post policy implementation complaints, a lot of them are based on how that housing authority handles the policy implementation. Have you communicated really well right from the beginning? Did you get those signs up, maybe a couple weeks before the policy went into effect so people can start incorporate it into their daily life? Have you had tenant meetings? Have you communicated with the community? Have you thought of ways you can support your tenants? I mean, you don't have to do all those things. And certainly we have many housing authorities who haven't. And some of them have not had any problems. But we've had a couple, because they didn't do these things, are now experiencing problems. And I do feel like at least some of that onus is on them, because they did not implement things in a comprehensive way that communicates to everyone and also communicates how serious they are about the policy.
Great. So let's go ahead and talk about some of the messaging that helps also with that process of overcoming some of those concerns in your presentation.
Okay. So again, this is the tenant presentation that we have given numerous times. And you'll see the very first slide is that we're not asking people to quit smoking. This is not about evicting people who smoke, but it's all about improving the air quality in housing and protecting the health of all tenants. And you'll see at the end of my presentation, we put that same slide up, that exact same slide up again at the very end of the presentation, because these are our key messages right here. And when you have a group full of people in the room who are kind of bubbling with anger potentially, these are three key questions you get. Well, I've lived here 20 years. You can't evict me for this. Well, this is not what this is about. We're not talking about evicting people. If you follow the policy, you will not be evicted, well, at least for this. that brings me to some other thing. I don't know what you guys have found, but we also find that folks who don't follow this policy are also not following other lease provisions. We have never had an eviction in Maine that was only based on a smoking violation. We have had evictions that include smoking violations, but it's usually, a list of 10 other things that tenant is not following as well. That's kind of our first introduction there to make sure folks really understand what this is not about. And then we go into secondhand smoke in general. You guys have probably mostly seen that slide. And then we go into the secondhand smoke basics, the 101, how it's a group A carcinogen, how there's no it causes cancer in humans. You should be ready, I think, if you're doing tenant meetings or when you're talking to tenants, that also there's certainly a percentage, I don't know what that percentage is, but a percentage of folks who don't trust any of this science, and they won't believe anything you have to say about it. with those folks, we just try to be as empathetic as possible to their situation or whatever is causing them to not believe 50 years of science. At that point, you just have to drop it and just be sympathetic to them, because they're not going to hear you anyway. So we do a lot of nodding and saying, I understand, that must be really hard. How can we help make sure that you follow the policy type of language? We also, of course, talk about ventilation, how there's no ventilation system that's available as of today that will remove those toxins. That's just a little bit more about ventilation, so they know it's not just us making those statistics up. We talk about a little bit about what happens in Maine specifically, how many people are dying because of secondhand smoke who don't even smoke. this is always, we always use this slide, especially when housing professionals are in the room, because they do deal with so many regulated toxins and chemicals that we like to point out that secondhand smoke is at least as deadly, arguably more deadly than the things up on your screen, arsenic, lead, asbestos, and people who live in housing understand that these are some of the toxins or chemicals that they've had to deal with in one form or another. So it's a good kind of comparison. Again, you probably know all these statistics, so I like to point out how much time people spend indoors, because it's a lot, especially in Maine. It's a lot of time indoors. And that helps them understand, it helps them understand that if they're inside 90% of the time, and their neighbor's inside 90% of the time, and the smoke and their smoke is being breathed by their neighbor, that's a huge majority of that neighbor's time that they're spending breathing their air. And that's I find that one statistic does seem to resonate with people. And of course, really getting them to understand that, hey, elderly, disabled folks, people with pre-existing conditions, it's a problem for everyone, but this is especially a problem to them. And then we like to put in some information about children, just to remind them how even more specifically it is dangerous to children. And I think this is maybe we have a couple more secondhand smoke slides. And we do tend to spend quite a bit of time on this because, again, back to my point that you really want to get everyone understanding what the problem is. This isn't something you and your secondhand smoke hating friends came up with, in the hallway. This is a lot of data and science over a lot of years. We talk a little bit about third-hand smoke. We don't spend too much time on that. And then we talk a little bit about residential property damage. It's interesting. I always think that this residential service property damage is going to be a flop, and I'm always surprised at how much this resonates with people. That, I didn't really realize, that when I move out or when, Joe moved out, they had to work on that unit for 2 weeks. And that's a lot of money. I guess I was surprisingly pleased at how much people really, that this did mean something to them. For the most part, people care about where they live and they appreciate having housing. So, damage to their properties and the buildings that they live in does seem to mean something to folks. We don't spend a lot of time on it because we don't want folks to start thinking that this is the only reason that people pass the policy, even if it was. We don't want to pass on that type of message. But we go into a little bit, you've seen these at people's houses and obviously these are going to have to be replaced. In other units, they can wash the carpets, but in units that had smokers and things happened, you know, they have to replace all this stuff, and it is very, very expensive. So there's just a couple of pictures that people go, oh, yeah. And then back to our fire message, making sure people understand that, again, residential fires caused by improperly discarded cigarettes are a big deal. I don't have it in here, but I usually have a slide from the most recent housing authority that had a fire you know, normally in those fires, it's not good. Someone or multiple people have died, or at the very least, 10, 20 people have been displaced. And that's, no one wants that. So then we go on to a little bit about their big arguments. And these are arguments that we have all heard. These are kind of the basic arguments about isn't smoking a right. And that is certainly a big complaint just thing that people fall back on. Well, it's my right to smoke, and it's my civil liberty. If I want to kill myself, that's, you know, I should be able to. And so we like to kind of nip that fallback in the bud and make sure people know before we get into discussion that, hey, there's actually no right to smoke. There's no law that protects you and allows you to smoke. It's a personal choice and it's an addiction, but there's no law that protects you and allows you to smoke. And also making sure they understand, hey, you're living in a, I mean, without, you know, being too nose up in the air, we also like to remind them that this is rental property. In rental property, the property owner can do whatever they want with that property, you know, within reason. Within reason and within the lease, the confines of the lease. This is their property. Anyone in the United States can prohibit smoking on their property. It's their right to do that. So we like to make sure we get that type of education and message out there before it opens up into discussion, so we don't even have to talk about whether it's somebody's right or not. And then these next three or four of them, we skim through a little bit, but we talk a little bit about how one thing the Housing Authority needed to consider is that many times actually now across the nation, folks who were non-smokers and were hurt by smoke have been suing their landlords and have the right to ask for provisions to protect them from secondhand smoke. Because, again, this is a dangerous chemical. We go on, like I said, I kind of skimmed through these a little bit because, A, it's more the information than the average tenant needs, but sometimes you get a tenant in the room who really knows their ADA or FHA information or, you know, whatever. They used to be a lawyer or they have already had a reasonable accommodations request. So they know all about it, and sometimes they have questions. So it's just good, again, to a little bit skim over this, that, hey, someone who has a breathing difficulty cannot be discriminated against. So if you're smoking next to someone else who has COPD or emphysema, you know, that person, not only are they in real danger, but you're going to have to move that person. They're going to fall into reasonable accommodations. And especially if the housing authority has already had to do that multiple times, it's not necessarily a bad thing to bring up, saying, hey, we're having to move people left and right because they can't be exposed to your secondhand smoke. At some point, that becomes cost prohibitive for us to be able to move people all the time to accommodate smokers. So we just make sure people know, hey, HUD really supports this. Matter of fact, HUD doesn't just support it, they encourage it at this point. And we've heard recently that, you know, within a year, HUD may start to require this in their housing authorities. So who knows? And then, of course, we in Maine, we make sure our tenants and our public housing authorities know that there's pretty much an equal playing field now. You're not going to go to the town next door and find a place that you can smoke in low-income housing. Well, maybe with Section 8, but we're working on that. So we really like them to know that whether it's Portland that just passed this, you know, whoever, they know this is not a fly-by-night type of phenomenon. It's happening certainly all over Maine, all over the nation. And it's not something, again, you can go to the next town and find housing that you can smoke. And, of course, our favorite message, that this is about the smoke, not the smoker. It brings us back to the basic messages of this is not about evicting people. This is not about asking people to quit. This is about what is best for the health of everyone in the building. We do usually, in Maine, we have a telephonic quit line that's free and offers free support. So we will usually mention that with the caveat of, again, we're not asking people to quit. But one thing we know is a policy like this will most likely spur some people to try to quit or to actually quit. For those people who want to quit, we want to support you. And here's one way that the state does that. Here's other ways that the Smoke-Free Housing Coalition can support you. And then we go on back to that first slide again. And we kind of end it with that. We have the Housing Authority come back and talk about, again, based on the objectives of the meeting, they may talk about services that they, you know, maybe they're going to provide some cessation services. You know, maybe they've worked with their local hospital or the Lung Association or someone else to come in and help with that for a period of time. And again, that's just about supporting the people who want to quit. Again, it's not saying people have to quit, but it's a real display of, I think, just support and care for your tenants that, hey, if you do quit, I mean, another thing we know is 92% of people who smoke want to quit. So what a nice way to support your tenants if those tenants who want to quit smoking. So I think that's it's something we don't necessarily say you really should do, but it's something that we always bring up with landlords and property owners is, hey, is this something that you want to talk about? So I think that's it for me.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. Let's go ahead and open up. Anybody have any questions for Tina that you would like to ask at this time? Let's see. We have one that came in via the chat.
I see that. Does taking the smoke outside and creating policies concerning smoking in public parks cause conflict? Meaning like someone who you prohibit it from the building, but then it's right next to a public park?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, we're telling people, we'll take it outside, you know, you need to do that. And right now I'm in a place that has a park right next to it. And if we get to the point where you can't smoke in public parks, then people are like, well, you know, what do you do? So I guess I'm saying if we say take it outside to appropriate places,
right,
would that be a different... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's a good question, John. And it's really something that your housing authority or your property owner needs to think about before passing the policy. Because obviously there's a million different ways to craft the policy. I mean, you can make it just the inside of the buildings are smoke free, or 25 feet from doors, windows, and entrances. You can say the whole property has to be smoke free. But no matter what you do, people are still going to smoke. It's not like everyone's going to quit. So where do they go? So a great point that folks really need to look at their properties and decide, Okay, people are going to smoke, so where are they going to go? If there's a park next door, what is the park policy? Our parks in Maine are pretty much all smoke-free, so that wouldn't be an option for us. And it's also not really, that's probably not where you want to push people, is a park where there's probably children. That's probably not a good community choice, I guess. So where else can they go? Is there anywhere else on the property that you could map out for them? And I use map out because some of our housing authorities have actually done that for all of their buildings, made maps and said, here's where you can smoke. So that's not a bad idea. We have housing authorities who have gone so far as to build gazebos where folks can smoke. Or put up lean-tos, like kind of tent type of structures. Of course, the thing to always remember is if you create a smoking area, 50 feet from the building, that smoking area has to be accessible, meaning you have to shovel it. Shovel the snow. So you want to consider that. We've had some housing authorities who we're kind of interested in making some type of shelter away from the building, but when they realized that needed to be accessible and they were going to have to shovel all the snow and it was going to be a maintenance issue, they said, in light of that, we're just going to make the entire property smoke-free. So those are some of the decisions that you want to consider. It's probably not ideal, but you could also do a policy building by building. If you had one building, the one that was next to the park, maybe your policy for that building is that they can only smoke in a designated area on the property, and you designate that area, again, probably not in the park, but somewhere else. And maybe other properties you could just do 25 feet from doors, windows, and entrances. So, you really have to look at each of those properties.
Hey, Tina, it's Pete. One of the things that I'm doing right now with the City of Boulder Housing Authority is what we've agreed to do is they are going to figure out which are the best places to have their designated smoking areas in each building. Then they're going to go to the residents and say, well, these are the possibilities. Which ones do you prefer? So get the residents' buy-in also on which ones they like. So that's just another thought for people.
That's a great idea. I love that. Because then you're giving them, some choices. You're giving them at least one thing to have a say on.
Are there any other questions?
I'll just add, Pete, I think everyone has the PowerPoint, and you guys we're not very proprietary in Maine, so you guys are more than welcome to take our slides and, revise them and put them into your own templates or whatever and use our information.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I did not send out the PowerPoint to most of the participants before the call, but I will after the call. So everybody who's part of our smoke-free housing network will get a copy of that, but I'm glad you mentioned that.
We'll send you the bill, Pete.
Thanks.
Tina, this is Jill at the health department. Thank you so much. I really like the way you've organized this, and we can benefit greatly from your lessons learned in terms of how you do the communication with all groups. I think this is really helpful. I do have one question. When you were talking about letters to the editor, and I would guess you have some similar kinds of editorial boards, that we have some very pro-libertarian type of thinking in many of our editorial boards. And in fact, we have one of our large papers, we have someone who wrote a book about the nanny state and very much about this kind, and uses smoke-free policies frequently in examples of government gone bad and out of control.
Sure.
So So how do you frame letters to the editor given that kind of a environment?
We live in a similar but not quite so conservative probably environment here. Although I have to say, we've been, because of our smoke-free housing campaign in general, we spent the first probably 3 years, excuse me, we spent probably the first 3 years educating the public and our media outlets on smoke-free housing in general and the science behind secondhand smoke and how it travels from unit to unit. So we haven't had that type of response. Our newspapers are actually pretty, very much in favor of smoke-free housing at this point. But I think it was largely due to, like I said, about 3 years of education. So without that luxury to spend, you know, the next 3 years educating and not doing policy, I would venture to say, I always tell people, Jill, and I'd be interested to come out to Colorado and argue with that guy, because I have always found that when people understand smoke-free housing, they understand it, and they understand it in a way that they then become a proponent of it. Because we are talking about civil liberties here. Absolutely. We're having the same argument. They're just not really understanding the civil liberties, or they're not willing to look at the civil liberties of the other person. I'd like that guy to have one phone call from somebody whose child has asthma and they've been to the ER 4 times in the last month because the person next door to them continued to smoke. I mean, let's have that argument. Where is that woman's civil liberties? That child continues to go to the ER. I mean,
yep, great. Thank you. That's the way I like to frame it as well. So I was just curious on how you take that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we used to say, we don't say it as much anymore, but, you know, it's like somebody who, maybe this isn't a very good example, but, you know, I can take my hand and put my, make a fist and punch out, you know, into the air. I can do that all day until it hits your face. And then I have violated your rights because I've hit you in the face. It's the same with smoking. I can smoke all day, but as soon as it hits someone else, I've violated their right to breathe. And everyone has a right to breathe. So I don't know. Those are the kinds of arguments I guess we've used. We really take the heartstrings approach, though, with a lot of times in terms of, because those are real phone calls that probably you guys have all gotten from folks. They're heart-wrenching phone calls from people who have no options. They live in housing. They live in Section 8 or public housing. They can't move, or there's a wait list to move, or they don't have the money to move, obviously, into market rate. They don't have any choices. So that's my best argument, I guess.
I'd like to get back to some of the questions in terms of, again, talking to residents here. I think also, you know, with letters to the editor, you always have to look at your environment and what the education, what you've done and what the goal of those letters are as well, and whether you have prepared, you know, planted the right seeds before you put those letters out. Maybe letters that from residents talking about it would be more appropriate, perhaps.
And thanking the housing authority for protecting them.
Right. Are there any other? We have maybe about 5 more minutes here. Are there any other questions for Tina in terms of working with residents or presentations to residents?
This is John. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
It's like your analogy about punching in the air, which is a good one, but it's also like the one of roping off a swimming pool and saying this part you can pee in.
Right.
There is no clean pool once you do that.
Right, right.
So, are there any more questions for Tina in terms of dealing with residents?
This is Karen in Delta.
Ooh.
I just have a question about do any surveying tips that you can talk about, some things that were successful when you were doing resident surveys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did do quite a few resident and tenant surveys back in 2003, 2004, 2005, I guess. We're actually doing it currently in one of our, I had mentioned we have two housing authorities that passed policies several years ago with unlimited grandfathering policies, and the one, Sanford, is abolishing it, and the other one is dragging their feet. So we're going to do a resident survey there about abolishing their unlimited grandfathering policy. And I think the keys to success, because we had really good response rates with our tenant surveys, which is important. One is to provide an incentive. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. Make sure you provide an incentive. We always did drawings for grocery, like gift cards to grocery stores. So we did a self-addressed stamped postcard. The postcard, so it was five questions, very short, enough to fit on a postcard. Again, self-addressed, stamped and everything. If they sent it back with their name on it, they were entered into a drawing for $50 grocery card gift certificate, because everyone can use that. And what was the other thing? Oh, the other thing we did was we did not have it sent to the housing authority because, you know, tenants sometimes are nervous about feeling like they're complaining or they don't want any chance of retribution on the side of the housing authority. So we had it sent to us as opposed to the housing authority, so they never, you know, they didn't feel unsafe. We assured people that the housing authority would not have anyone's names, and we certainly held to that. We coded the cards, the postcards, we always coded them per building or per, you know, site, so we could break it down per site, the results by site, and that was helpful for us. But again, I think the pretty basic, make it short, make it sweet, provide an incentive, and have it sent back to an outside source. I think if you do those things, you'll have success.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Any questions?
Hi, this is Beverly in Denver. I had a question. How did you involve the youth, Tina?
We didn't.
Okay.
Although I love that idea. I think that's a great idea to pull the youth in to be proponents of your policy implementation. This is going to sound maybe a little, I don't know, not quite so right, but especially if you had youth who had, you know, asthma or any, or youth who had siblings who had asthma or any other types of breathing problems or had family members with breathing problems. The kids are great, but the kids are especially great when they can pull on the heartstrings of other people. And by giving their own story, that can be really powerful.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. I think we're a little bit past our hour here in terms of our conference call. So at this time, if you have any other questions for Tina, you can send them to me, and I will forward them to Tina. And I will be following up with some of you after this call later as well. Did I hear somebody say something?
No, Pete, this is Elizabeth Andrews, and I'm sorry I joined the call a little late, but it certainly is a wonderful resource in Montana as prevention specialists are starting to look at their work plans for the following year. My question is, and they often need a little more advance notice than I do to jump on these things, but is there a schedule of similar opportunities for people who are going to be working in their local communities on these types of policies in the year to come?
I'll address that with you at some, via email, or I'll call you later.
Okay, yes, if there's a calendar, a place where I can just go and see the ones that are upcoming, and that would be great.
Sure. Any other quick questions? All right, Tina, I want to thank you so much again for being a host. I'm glad to hear you again, talk with you again. You have such great insight, and I just want to mention to everybody, and I don't know if it's still true, that Maine has been one of the leaders, and not only have they been one of the leaders, they've worked on a shoestring budget for years and years, and they've accomplished a great amount of work on that shoestring budget. So thank you, Tina.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.